Recording live from the Hoban Law Group here in Denver, Colorado, I'm your host, Eric Singular. We're sitting alongside president and founder of the Hoban Law Group, Bob Hoban.
You know, Bob, yesterday we were celebrating, we were discussing this announcement from the DEA about Epidiolex being removed from the controlled substances list. And today our hearts are heavy as we are mourning the passing of Charlotte Figge, who was such a hero in this industry for getting the tide to turn and the perceptions to shift around cannabis as medicine. What are your thoughts on all of this?
Well, certainly it's a sad day, and it really is a marker of the road just to see how serious this virus is and how it can impact just about anybody. You know, as an aside, before we talk about Charlotte, because it's just such a thick and heavy topic, there's a guy that was maybe 10 years, 12 years older than I was when I was in high school, named Marty Durr. And Marty Durr was a beast. He was a bull. And he'd bring him into our basketball practices, and he would always, you know, he was brought in to toughen us up and bully us and you know, during practice to be stronger inside with the basketball. Well, I got news also yesterday that Marty Durr, this beast of a man, also died at 56 years old from complications related to this coronavirus. So our hats off to both families there. But at the end of the day, it really lets you know that this thing has no scope, no bounds in terms of young people, people that aren't so old, that were in fairly good shape. It really hits you across the bow so many times. But let's do talk about Charlotte, because think about this for a minute. We talked, and I've read several articles today. I learned about this last night, and it just made me reflect on how far this industry has come because of her, because of when we were all introduced to her on CNN and how that really brought medical marijuana to the forefront. But I see these articles, and it talks about, oh, she brought CBD, or her family brought CBD to the forefront, and that is such a limitation or restriction, an understatement as it relates to her impact on the world and her family's impact. And let's not forget, Charlotte was a wonderful, brave young girl, and her mother and her family have really worked so hard to get this issue out there. But how brave they were to take a risk and move to Colorado and then go on the news. I mean, think about that. But the impact there is so broad, so much broader than just CBD, or so much broader than hemp. Eric, when's the first time you heard of Charlotte?
Well, I agree with you so much. And, you know, here in Colorado especially, that name Charlotte's Web, of course, an entendre a bit, because it references such a great classic book. But that's a household name here in Colorado. I want to hear you talk, though, a little bit more about the limitation of just saying that she was, responsible for advancing the CBD industry. Because think about it like this, you know, she really shifted the whole perception around cannabis. And I'm thinking specifically about policymakers, legislators. When they saw her, it really made them think about cannabis as medicine in a different way. Wouldn't you agree?
100%. Think about it, state by state. Think about just how impactful it was. Forget about the legislative impact for a minute, because we can get to that. But think about the impact that this story had, and her relief, and the visible relief on her parents' face on those video clips from that CNN special, Weed, back in 2013. Think about how that impacted people. It made you change your mind. It made you stop thinking that medical marijuana was somehow just some sort of cover up or ruse for a bunch of people that wanted to, you know, use it in sort of the stereotypical stoner fashion. It changed the narrative. Then that story, it changed public opinion on the news, on our media, but it also had the ripple effect of making that so powerful that family was able to carry that message and have such a broader impact, not just with their daughter, but beyond that, so many other families, and to changing the criminal justice around it. Think of the impact. Think how far it goes from sort of mainstreaming the idea that cannabis is medicine, then that leading to legislation and commercial businesses and criminal justice reform. That is extremely powerful, Eric. I mean, think about that lasting legacy, because state by state, whether it was Florida, Colorado, California, as they went down and they interacted with these legislators, it changed people's minds because they saw it with their own two eyes.
Well, absolutely. And I encourage anybody who, you know, who feels the weight of this, reach out. You know, we've seen a huge outpouring on social media to whether it's Charlotte's Web or to the Stanley Brothers or the Realm of Caring, all of the different channels that they had, you know, just go support them. Let them know that they are in your thoughts. You know, this is a difficult time on its own, especially difficult with this happening. It's just there's no words, Bob. It's a real hit.
No doubt about it. No doubt about it. And you do see, like I said, on social media, you see the impact. And it's really kind of felt around the world. You see messages from many of our Latin American colleagues in Spanish talking about Charlotte and the legacy that she leaves behind. But really created a lot of positive movement in so many different ways and helped so many people. And it really is sad that this virus just, you know, took her into to its grips. But her message, her flame will live on, her love light, if you will carry on and on and on because of the lasting impact that we all continue to get to be a part of.
It certainly will. It certainly will. And, you know, it is wild to see that global outpouring. Because again, as you always say, Bob, you know, there's so many different opinions on how do you even think about this industry? How do you define the cannabis industry? And as you always say, it is global. This is a global industry. And, you know, a hero in any part of the industry is a global hero. You know, shifting gears a little bit, I want to talk about this. The essential treatment of cannabis. We've talked about this on the Hoban Minute a lot. But let's think about the implications here. Does the essential treatment of cannabis render distinctions between medical and recreational adult use meaningless? What's going on?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's a thick question. Let me try to take it a step back. There's this notion that somehow, some way, there's a vast distinction between medical marijuana and adult use marijuana in the United States in our dispensary-based system. And I'm not saying that there's not a distinction from a scientific and medical perspective. I don't doubt the medicinal benefits of this plant even for a second. However, from a public policy standpoint, I don't see the need for us to continue to make this distinction. Think about the fact that in Colorado, we started as a medical marijuana regulatory system, and then we went to the adult use system because our voters enacted that in 2012. And now we have these two regulated systems standing side by side. Many of the businesses have both licenses. They get to participate as a medical marijuana dispensary, meaning a patient with a card has to come in and be eligible to purchase. And an adult use system where you simply have to be over a certain age, 21 in this context. So is there really a distinction? Now, this is important because I'm not saying that there's not a distinction. It's just public policy. Look at the state of Washington. They eliminated the distinction between their marijuana collective-based system to a state adult use system. It all merged into one. And the market will drive, I can give you examples of this, the market will drive products into those adult use dispensaries or those just over-the-counter marijuana dispensaries to service the patient market as well. We see this with CBD. Why else would marijuana adult use stores serve and provide CBD products, especially hemp-based CBD products or produce CBD products of their own unless they cater to a market that desired products for medicinal use? So I do believe that merging those markets is critical. Now, let me also suggest from a public policy, then I'll come back to your question, from a public policy perspective, This is all over-the-counter marijuana. There's really three distinct swim lanes from public policy. You've got your FDA lane, your approved medicines, specific formulas for specific conditions. And then you've got your over-the-counter marijuana lane, which is effectively our dispensary system here, state by state in the U.S. And then you've got your wellness lane or your nutraceuticals lane, which encompasses CBD products, other non-psychoactive formulations that alleviate conditions taking in low doses, not condition specific. You got hemp foods that fall into that wellness and nutraceuticals category because they do contain high nutritional content with proteins, omega-3s, omega-6s. So those are your three distinct lanes. And over-the-counter marijuana is over-the-counter marijuana. And by the way, it's probably a good thing that it's regulated intrastate, state by state, but that's another topic for another day. Now, come a full circle. Back to your question. Does the coronavirus highlight the fact that this distinction doesn't need to be made? I think it does. I think that politicians are making false distinctions between marijuana dispensaries as essential for medical use, medical marijuana, versus adult use. Our own mayor here in the city of Denver made that distinction. Upon the shelter-in-place lockdown and identifying what were essential businesses, the mayor said at 2 p.m. on that particular day, a week or two ago, that marijuana, medical marijuana businesses were essential, but adult use businesses were not. Consumers behaved the way you would expect them to behave within hours. The store lines at the adult use stores were very long. Well, the governor reversed course on that and said all marijuana businesses are eligible as essential businesses by 5 p.m. that very same day. So my point being, in a time of crisis or in a time when you're trying to, you know, ultimately keep businesses open, keep businesses afloat, keep things that people need available to them, you're making a false distinction between what is simply over-the-counter marijuana, because medical marijuana in the United States doesn't really mean medicine, even though it has so-called medicinal benefit. It's medicine is defined differently. It means in the U.S., medicinal marijuana means safe, quality, consistent access to product, not that it's scientifically designed from a medical perspective to impact you. Like it is, medical marijuana means different things in different places.
But isn't that the element here that almost touches Charlotte's legacy? What do I mean is the access. On the one hand, when you label these businesses as essential services, on the one hand, you have it treated, you know, the medical system as patients. That's how we define the people who go and buy products at medical dispensaries. And then on the other hand, you have recreational customers just being that, customers. Now, I guess what I'm getting at is, you know, we don't know or we don't know how to qualify the amount of people who are using the recreational space and the recreational sector for medicine and for access. So doesn't this speak a little bit to her legacy? And to your point, you know, why do we have this distinction, this bifurcation? It just seems more and more to be unnecessary, especially now in what has come to light and the way we've treated these businesses in the wake of COVID.
No, that's really, really well said, and it is a way to tie together those two topics and bring it back to Charlotte on this day, and you know that impact. The fact of the matter is, from a policymaker perspective, because there's so much stigma around this plant in the United States for a variety of reasons that we can't even begin to go into today. There's so much stigma around this plant, and that stigma really, really resonates with politicians, and they draw a deep, hard line about marijuana policy change or decriminalization or legalization or regulation. It was the medical topic that got politicians who would not have otherwise looked at this plant as a viable alternative or anything other than the stoner scenario we talked about a while ago. That got the politicians to look at it differently. And that's the weird thing about it, is we had to come at politicians as a grassroots movement to effectuate medical marijuana change. It didn't come from the medical community. In fact, very few physicians are even educated about the endocannabinoid system worldwide in their typical MD programs or the equivalent in different countries around the world. So my point being that we have a grassroots movement with people that demonstrated in real life with their brave families taking steps to put this on the map. Here we are today, where if my mother were still alive, and she passed away in 2011, I didn't have the benefit of being able to walk into a store with my mother and say, hey, here's the variety of offerings. This is what could help you with the effects of chemotherapy and the pain from pancreatic cancer. But instead, we had to make calls to caregivers who helped when you found the right ones, but otherwise, it wasn't the experience that she deserved. And Charlotte has that lasting impact now that somebody whose daughter, son, brother, mother needs help can walk into a store with them and obtain things and try and see what works for them.
No, it's an absolute shift in stigma and perception. Really just, that's a huge part of what the Hoban Minute is all about, is just shifting perspectives. I think this is a great moment to reflect on that as we reflect on her legacy and going forward. Now, this brings up another interesting point, though. When we look at the essential treatment of these businesses, we have seen such a rush on dispensaries. You mentioned when Mayor Hancock announced the closing of dispensaries, people flooded them so much that they had to roll back that ordinance. So this has led a lot of people, we've seen this come up in the headlines a lot, that this industry, the cannabis industry, whatever that is recession-proof. I want your take on this, Bob. Is it recession-proof? What the heck is the cannabis industry, I guess, in the first place?
Yeah, no, those are great questions, and they're absolutely related. Is the cannabis industry recession-proof? I've heard this question asked so many times over the last couple of weeks, and the resounding response from well-educated people that I respect, financial advisors and the like, the response seems to be yes. It is indeed recession-proof. And while I respect that position, I think that it's not exactly true. Is the cannabis industry recession-proof? The plant itself, the demand for cannabis, whether in smokable form, oil form, or the like, the demand is indeed recession-proof. Both, as we've talked about, medicinal users, adult use, recreational users, the demand exists, particularly in times like this where people are using the product for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is self-medication just to get by. So the demand for the product is absolutely recession-proof. However, the demand for the act of the industry being recession-proof, that's a question that I doubt about. I wouldn't say that the industry itself is recession-proof, because we can't even agree as a country, as a state, let alone a region or a world, what the so-called cannabis industry really is. The cannabis industry is made up of course, the marijuana side of the industry and the industrial hemp side of the industry, using legal terminology. That's what the two sides of the industry are. And if you can't even agree public policy-wise, through the United Nations as a baseline with their conventions, to say this is what the product is, this is how it should be regulated by its uses. Medical marijuana means things all over the world, but marijuana or cannabis legalization means so many things to different people around the world. In Canada, they might regulate it and legalize it for health purposes. In Latin American countries, they might do it to eliminate the narco trade or to provide economic development. In the European Union, they might just be all in on medical cannabis and how you can use that at a very high level to develop formulas to help people from a medicinal perspective. In Africa, the African nations have legalized it for other reasons. So my whole point is that we can't even agree whether the cannabis industry is marijuana, is it hemp, is it CBD. We don't really have a common understanding, nor do we have a common public policy or legislative framework anywhere around the world. So what we're doing as lawyers, and what so many hardworking folks in the industry are doing is trying to connect the dots and create a global supply chain in and of itself. But we don't quite understand what that means yet. We still don't all agree what this is. And then you've got dispensary owners in state X or Y saying, well, what does it matter to me what's happening outside of the U.S.? Because all I can do is operate in my particular state. So we don't even have a common understanding. We don't have common regulation. We don't have common policy. So the industry, as a recession-proof thing, does not and cannot exist, particularly in the face of federal illegality of marijuana here in the United States. So my point is, there is a distinction there between the demand for the product and how it's distributed from the commercial elements of what the industry is. The industry is not recession-proof. The plant is.
This is where things get so sticky, Bob, because as you say, and you're absolutely right, we cannot agree on the definition of this industry at the state level, at the federal level. So you have international organizations who really do, they're responsible for creating these global policies. I'm thinking primarily, and you brought this up, but the United Nations. And we had a cannabis designation scheduled for them to reconsider it as a controlled substance at that global level. Now this has been postponed. But I want to know what your thoughts are on this in the first place. Is there the way that the World Health Organization and the United Nations, are they looking at this from maybe kind of a fractured perspective? And if so, what does it need to be? How do they need to shift their thinking at that global defining level for what cannabis is?
That's a great point. I think that the people on the committee for the United Nations, the Committee of Narcotic Drugs, I believe that they're hard workers and they're really trying to get this right. But I believe that organization and the folks that have the most influence as activists and lobbyists there are lobbying on the same policy issue and messaging that has been around for several decades now. And that messaging has changed because we are now operating in a global cannabis industry, which is indeed a 100% commercial and largely regulated environment. This is not lobbying the United Nations or advancing change through the Committee on Narcotic Drugs to effectuate criminal justice reform or social policy reform or to better lay out how drugs should be evaluated on a controlled substances uniform basis when you look at marijuana. But we're talking about operating in a commercial environment. It's like that Allen Iverson thing from back in the day. You're talking about practice. You're talking about a commercial environment. You're not talking about social justice reform any longer. So to lobby the United Nations and to work with the World Health Organization, who has advanced forward-thinking scientific conclusions regarding cannabis that are almost exclusively favorable, to wait for the United Nations to make a decision based on the same kind of narcotic reform policies and efforts that have not really succeeded for decades means that there needs to be a change. And that change of focus needs to be on how this is a global cannabis economy. And when you regulate the plant from a public policy perspective at the United Nations level, you have to consider it in four distinct policy lanes. So I'm expanding the three lanes to the fourth lane by suggesting that we regulate the plant by its uses. And by the way, the cannabis plant is, under the United Nations Convention, already regulated and addressed by its particular uses. But those lanes need to be carved out and need to be specifically identified with model legislation or model policy from different places around the world. So if you take those four buckets, the industrial use lane, cannabis regulations and policy that flow from that lane should not have any impact on whether or not marijuana is controlled or not, because the uses derived from the plant are not going to be consumed by human beings or used for any sort of medicinal or drug efficacy. Second lane, we talked about this already, the FDA-approved medicines lane, very distinct, Big Pharma, pharmaceutical companies, the third lane being the nutraceutical companies, the idea that a wellness and a food and supplement line could support this plant. And then over-the-counter marijuana, effectively dispensary systems, people that want to access marijuana flower and marijuana oil in its natural state, not as an approved drug. All of those things can and should be allowed worldwide. Now, how do you create those policy lanes and affect that change? You have to view it through that lens. I was on a stage at a particular convention in Vienna in December of 2018, and I mentioned that. And a couple of folks in the audience said, that's crazy. That's a crazy policy perspective, because their perspective was, this is medicinal cannabis, and it needs to be made available to patients. Well, that, of course, is part of this. You just have to think that the plant is far more useful than just medicine, although its medicinal benefits are off the charts. You have to realize that this plant can do so many different things and feed so many different industries and can be commoditized in so many different ways. And the public policy that comes from the UN needs to specifically consider that and address that. And it is not a drastic change based on the way things are structured right now.
You cannot undervalue the message that you are saying there, especially when you think about that the United Nations, this is why it exists. This is the entire thrust of what they are doing, to create that model policy around the world. And that model policy is not something that is, shrouded in mysticism, or we don't know what it is. We know what it is. As you're saying, there are these distinct four regulatory lanes, and it is, it's pretty cut and dry, and it's pretty straightforward when you really break it down in that way. Bob, I thank you for joining me on this fine afternoon. And for all of our listeners to the Hoban Minute, we thank you for tuning in. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Hoban Minute special series on coronavirus and cannabis. You can head on over to hoban.law for more information on this podcast or the Hoban Law Group. If you have any ideas for subjects that we should be covering or any questions you want to pose to Bob or myself, shoot us an email at media@hoban.law. Stay tuned for the next episode on this special series, Coronavirus and Cannabis.